The Tom Woods Show, episode 429.
In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You've found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking today about how people are persuaded of things. Why is it that so often we feel like we're banging our heads against a wall when we're having political arguments with people? That no matter what we say, they won't accept it, or they won't accept the evidence that we're presenting. What's going wrong? What are we doing wrong in so many of these encounters we have with people who disagree with us? Why is it so difficult to crack through? And why are arguments on social media particularly fruitless? What's really going on here? Well, joining us to talk about this today is Jonathan Haidt, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And this book was mentioned all the way back on episode 393 by guest Michael Malice. He mentioned this in the course of a discussion that we had about how to persuade people of our ideas as libertarians, and the book intrigued me. So we got Jonathan Haidt on here to talk to us. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. Before coming to Stern, he taught for 16 years at the University of Virginia. His three TED Talks have been viewed more than 3 million times. He earned his BA in philosophy from Yale University in 1985 and received his PhD in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania in 1992. He was named one of the top global thinkers by Foreign Policy magazine and one of the top world thinkers by Prospect magazine. And it's my pleasure to welcome him to the show right now. Jonathan Haidt, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
I had a guest on several weeks ago, at least now, who was joining me to talk about how to persuade people of particular things. And I asked him at the end to name me a few books that he thinks would be helpful in thinking about all this. And just right off the bat, he said, Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind, you've got to read this book. And I am sorry to say, somehow, even though you've had millions of views of your TED Talks and you've been tremendously successful in so many ways, I'm sorry to say I wasn't familiar with your work at all. But then I got the book and I looked at it and I'm extremely intrigued. And I can't say I'm 1,000% persuaded, but I can't find what the hole is in your argument either, and it's driving me crazy. So can we start off by having you explain maybe the difference between how the average person thinks about how persuasion takes place and, you know, the dark truth about how it really takes place?
Okay. So when I die and I think about what I've left behind, eventually it'll probably just be one metaphor. And that metaphor is that the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant. And the rider represents your conscious verbal reasoning, the stuff you're aware of, the stuff that uses logic. And everything else is the elephant. It's the automatic processes. It's the 99% of what's going on in your mind that you're not aware of. And I developed this metaphor in my book, The Happiness Hypothesis, and then it was made famous not by me, but by Chip and Dan Heath in their wonderful book, Switch. And what the advice boils down to is most of us spend a lot of our time trying to persuade other people's riders. We give them all these reasons. Here are the 7 reasons why you're wrong or why you should see it my way. When in fact, the way to persuade people is to speak to the elephant first. The elephant is a lot stronger than the rider. If you get somebody feeling the truth of what you're saying or feeling that they like you or like what you're saying, and the elephant kind of wants to go in your direction, then it's effortless to persuade the rider to go along. But if the elephant is digging in its heels, the elephant doesn't want to go, doesn't want to be dragged along by you to the conclusion that you're trying to get them to, then there's really nothing you can say that will persuade the rider.
All right. Now, that is deeply frustrating on many levels to learn this because, of course, we for, you know, certainly since the Enlightenment, but I would say quite a while before that, there was a conviction throughout Western civilization that reason being the defining characteristic of human beings must be the criterion that we use. This must be the arbiter through which we judge our disputes. Now, I want to focus primarily on political questions as opposed to religious ones just because of the nature of the show. But is your thesis effectively saying, or at least implying, that rational political discourse will always be impossible?
No, it's not that it's impossible. It's that it can't work on an Enlightenment model. So, I like the Enlightenment as much as the next, professor, but the Enlightenment was not, let's just say there weren't any psychologists involved in it. Psychology had not really been invented in a sense. So, let me change that. David Hume is the Enlightenment figure who really got it right. He and also Adam Smith, but especially Hume, were just so wise about the nature of human thinking. And then on the other side, you've got people like Immanuel Kant and others who are very high systemizers, is what we say. The people who worshipped reason. I've written about what I call the rationalist delusion. I'm sure you and many of your listeners are aware of that funny scene in the French Revolution where they pull the Jesuses and Marys out of all the churches and they stick an image in of the God of reason. They stick an image of reason to take the place.
Yeah.
And this does not work. You can't have a religion based on reason. And if you do, you're going to destroy reasoning. So what I'm saying is political discourse can work once you recognize that we're all mostly elephants. I don't mean Republicans. I mean we're all mostly emotional social creatures. It can work, but it can't work if you're psychologically unsophisticated. And this is the problem that plagued the Democrats for so long. They just kept thinking about messaging as though if they could just get the right configuration of words and put it up into message space, it will somehow persuade people, and it doesn't work that way.
One thing I drew from reading your work is that you yourself, in the course of doing this work and coming to these conclusions, maybe began to have a little bit more understanding for people who disagree with you than you might have had before. And you seem to be suggesting that instead of just writing off half the population as being irrational idiots, we ought to think about them maybe a bit more sympathetically.
Absolutely. That's what happened to me. I was always on the left when I was growing up. I was raised Jewish in New York. I went to Yale. I don't know if I ever met a conservative. I guess there were three or four conservative students at Yale when I was there. But I never spoke to them because they were so yucky and we all hated them. I mean, it was a really partisan time in the 80s, and it's just gotten worse since then. So I actually started studying political psychology. I had been just looking at how morality varies across nations, and I started studying how it varies across the left-right divide, in part because I was so frustrated with the Democrats, since Al Gore's failed campaign. I was so frustrated that they didn't know how to talk about morality. But as I dug into it and as I really made a commitment to understanding conservatives, and I didn't even think about libertarians at the time, I just saw left-right, I began to see that if you listen to people who differ from you, they actually know things that you don't know, whereas when you only talk to people that agree with you, you don't learn very much from them. So in the course of doing this work, I actually kind of dropped. I'm no longer a liberal. I'm just kind of nothing now. I'm a professor. I study this stuff. I find it incredibly interesting. Everyone's got insight into problems. It helped me step out of the matrix, as it were.
Once we adopt an ideology, and not everybody has one, of course, right, in the U.S., but once we do, of course, we tend to view the whole world through that lens. And that means that when something contradicts our worldview, we, instead of thinking, maybe there's something wrong with the worldview, we immediately rush to find some corroborating evidence for our view that can refute whatever the anomaly is. And I, of course, have caught myself doing this quite a bit. And I've gotten to the point now where I feel more at ease saying, even right here on this show, a daily libertarian podcast, I feel completely at ease saying, I think this is a weak link in something I believe, and maybe it could be strengthened. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm willing to say this is a weak link. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I think I would have just felt like, we got to batten down the hatches. Yep. And, we have to make sure that we don't admit any weakness at all.
That's right.
And I think also we have to acknowledge that other people are coming at their views probably because in many cases because of experiences they've had growing up that it were formative for them, and it causes them to see the world in a particular way. And I used to think of people who were on the left or people who were neoconservatives as just being incorrigibly wicked and evil, and they won't evaluate evidence. But that's, you know, there are some people who are evil in mm-hmm. those camps. That's true, but I don't think that's most people. I think most people just, as I say, they've formed their opinions on the basis of things that are not stupid or mm-hmm. irrational.
Right.
Well, anyway, maybe non-rational might be a better way to think
about
it.
That's the word. Now,
in your work, you go ahead and list a series of categories, and you say these are the different ingredients in how we come to be who we are. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. So my research since graduate school has always been on morality, moral psychology, what it is, where it comes from. And in reading ethnographies, in reading a lot of anthropology, in doing some field work in India and in Brazil, I came to see that morality varies a lot around the world. And it's as though there are these sort of issues that seem to just tweak our minds. They just, you know, if you see a child being harmed, it's awful. It's like having a drop of lemon juice on your tongue. It just activates a taste bud that says, no, this is wrong. Or if somebody is shirking or not pulling their fair share of the weight, or if somebody is disloyal, or if somebody is disobedient, or if somebody behaves in a way that's degrading or disgusting. Now, I just named five foundations: care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And some of your listeners might have thought that the last couple aren't really morality with this, you know, disobedience, sanctity. One thing we know about libertarians, my colleagues and I have done what I think is the largest study of libertarian psychology, is that libertarians focus on primarily on liberty. So that's the sixth foundation is liberty. Libertarians have the strongest sense of personal liberty, and they want to extend it to others. And they have the weakest sense of group loyalty, respect for authority, or a sense of personal sanctity or purity. So libertarians are quite unique in their morality. I mean, they're diverse, of course, as well. But libertarians, in some ways, are more different from liberals and conservatives than liberals and conservatives are from each other. So my approach has been to identify the taste buds of the moral sense, and then the three major families of moral cuisines, what you might call progressive, social conservative, and libertarian.
When you drew these conclusions about libertarians, you got some pushback. I know you spoke at the Cato Institute, but you did get some pushback from some libertarians who were offended that you would suggest that they're not as caring. I mean, I think you were trying to be scientific in applying these labels. I don't think you were rendering moral judgments on anybody.
Right.
But I would just say that the libertarian view would be that maybe there isn't such a big division between being concerned about liberty and caring about others. Because it's not just I'm concerned about my own liberty. Our view is that society, most people in society are victims of like a society-wide Stockholm syndrome, that the very institution they look to help them is the one that is screwing them at every possible opportunity. Oh, the Federal Reserve is going to give you economic stability, then it gives you a housing bubble and bust that ruins half the country.
Yep.
Or the government is here just to protect you from the bad guys, whereas we look at the foreign policy of the U.S. government and we say, because we care about mankind, we have to stop this military machine. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of us took that very badly. We thought that's not the way we are.
Okay. Well, here's the cause of the misunderstanding. I'm not at all saying that libertarians don't care about others, don't care about the world. Here's the simplest way to summarize what's unique about libertarians. There are these two personality dimensions, empathizing and systemizing. Both of them are strengths, people who can think systemically. In academics, I know you have a PhD, in academics and engineering, and you know, being able to think systematically is an incredible strength. Libertarians are the best of any group at thinking systemically and systematically. That's why they're attracted to economics. Then there's this other trait, empathizing. It's the degree to which you feel others' pain. I don't mean that you care about what happens to them. I mean that you know, if somebody pokes themselves in the eye accidentally, you flinch because boy do you feel it. Or if they tell a sad story, you cry. libertarians are much lower. No, I shouldn't say much. Libertarians are statistically significantly lower than liberals or conservatives on those traits. So it's not a coincidence that libertarians are overwhelmingly male, because these are exactly the traits on which men and women differ. What we found in our paper, so I'd urge your listeners, if you just Google understanding libertarian morality, and then you put in my name, H-A-I-D-T, you'll find our paper. It's free online. It has all the graphs, all the tables. And what we find is that libertarians, whether they're male or female, have the most masculine cognitive style. And so even female libertarians are more masculine, and I don't mean macho. I mean higher systemizing, lower empathizing, more rational. And so when I present this these results, what I generally find is that libertarians generally say, yep, that's us. Yep, that's right. But it is true that some of them will say, wait a second, are you saying we're not caring? And I have to explain, as I just did. I hope that was clear enough.
No, I think so. And incidentally, on the show notes page for today, we will link to that article as well as your book. It's tomwoods.com/429. And of course, the other it's easy to misunderstand libertarians, so that's why there was this response that, oh, here's another guy who doesn't understand us. Because there were another point that Charles Murray has made is that when the government takes over certain functions, then certain aspects of society, of natural society, just tend to atrophy. If the state is going to take care of this or that function, then ordinary people are not going to volunteer to do that thing. And then the result is that the natural sympathy that people might have for each other is interfered with, because this voluntary aspect disappears. So anyway, I realize that's not the central thesis.
No, but that is a perfect example of how that is a really subtle point which you can't really grasp unless you're good at thinking systemically. And so it's a kind of a meta point. It's an understanding of how systems can crush personal caring and responsibility in relationships. But the average person, the more typical person, just says, oh, but if people are suffering, the government has to care for them. We can't just abandon them. So what I'm saying is libertarians are the clearest thinkers. They are the best thinkers about complex social questions and problems.
All right. In that case, I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, there you go. And back to your earlier question about how do you persuade people, acknowledgement. The key is acknowledgement. So either we're in combat mode, and you use the phrase battle stations or batten down the hatches, or we're in discovery mode or in relationship mode. There's three different modes. And often our discussions are in combat mode. And when that happens, when people have a sense that you're in combat mode, they just look for why you're wrong and they just want to argue against you. But if you're in curiosity mode, you're really trying to figure something out and you're looking to someone to help you do it, or if you're in relationship mode where you value a person and you want to get closer to them, it's like people suddenly they open up, their defenses melt down, and you can have really great conversations with people.
I hope you won't think this is too trivial, but I wonder if you've taken your conclusions here and tried to apply them to understanding why debates and discussions via social media are so unproductive.
Yes. Oh my God. It's so straightforward, and it's just so frustrating to see it all happening, because people have lots of social motives. And the people who are doing all that nasty stuff, it's mostly men, and it's mostly, I think, young men. Men have a particular need to show off how smart they are. So social media is not a place to go where people are trying to find truth or relationships. The places you're talking about, like especially the comments page on pretty much anything, anytime you ever give a talk or I give a talk and you look at the comments page, well, you may have a lot of people who just, love you and praise you, but, it's full of nasty, nasty stuff typically, because people are trying to show off. They're in show-off mode. They're trying to gain prestige. They're not trying to find the truth. So there's a great new site. I just signed on as an advisor to them called Parleo. I suppose it's parleo.com. But what they're doing is it's a social media discussion site where you basically get rewarded for being civil. You don't really have an option to be nasty. They limit membership. And so I think there are ways. Technology can be the greatest, our greatest friend in finding the truth and solving problems. But man, does it give a platform to idiots. No, I shouldn't say idiots. It gives a platform to normal people to show off in ways that are basically pissing on public trust.
Well, I'll include a link to that site as well at tomwoods.com/429, and I'll urge all my nice listeners to go over
civil,
there.
Civil, that's right, all your civil listeners.
Check that one out. Let me raise an argument that the public choice school has raised to account for why in political discussions and in political forming political allegiances, we tend to see non-rational motivations take over. And one of the reasons they'll give is that, especially when you're dealing with a presidential election, there is zero chance that your one vote is going to affect the outcome. So you know the logic of this, but just for the listeners and everybody, whereas when I go out and buy a TV, well, my one TV vote is going to mean everything because I go out, I cast my vote by putting those dollars down, I get the TV, so I'm going to make sure I know what the pluses and minuses are. I'm going to take a lot of care with it. Whereas given that I know I'm not influencing the outcome, and even if I did, I still don't know if the person who says he's going to do X, Y, and Z will really do X, Y, and Z, or if he does something stupid, there'll be a long time lag. I won't feel the effects, so therefore I'm going to be swept away by campaign slogans or an ad showing him with his dog. And so that is what helps to account for why we're not really talking about whether the debt is something to worry about or not.
Yeah, well, that's right as far as it goes, but you can go even further. I would say almost any social puzzle, you want to bring in psychology, but you don't just want to bring in cognitive psychology and the study of decision making. You want to bring in social psychology, look at people's social motives. So local politics seems to be mostly about self-interest. People care about their property values. But presidential politics in the United States is nothing like that. And as you say, it's really, you know, it's really not about self-interest. Certainly your vote itself won't change your outcome. But if you vote the wrong way, you could be ostracized from your social group. So voting is a way of displaying, it's a conspicuous display of your values, of the kind of person that you are. So that's why you get all this craziness. I mean, our founders didn't want a democracy because they thought, you know, people do all kinds of dumb things in a democracy. I mean, democracies are fantastic for accountability, for calling back leaders that are bad. But the idea that we're going to debate complicated policies like healthcare by having people vote on them or, have directly, direct democracy. I mean, it can work in some countries like Switzerland where people are really involved and really educated. But our country is pretty moralistic and people aren't voting for their self-interest. They're voting to display the kind of person they want people to think they are.
Yeah, and that actually is another point that I think the public choice people would make, because, of course, from the public choice perspective, there's no reason to vote. Given
yeah,
that no
right.
one person is
going right.
to, so therefore you have to account for why are people voting anyway. And I think a very important reason they're voting is, as you say, to reflect who they are. And related to that, a sense of belonging. I'm part of the American National Project by voting.
That's right.
Now, what I want to do is I want people to take away something from this discussion about how they might go about talking to other people about things that matter to them when those people might come at questions very different.
Sure.
And I wonder if there's an analogy to be made with the love languages, that there are people who want to be loved in certain ways, and there are things that matter to them. Like some people want physical things. Other people don't want physical things. They want affection or whatever. They have their own love language. Well, is what you're saying that I should try to figure out, well, not the love language of the person I'm talking to, but the relative ranking of these different factors like care and fairness or whatever, and try to explain myself with reference to those things that matter to them the most?
No, don't start by trying to explain yourself. Try to start by talking to the other person's elephant, by showing some appreciation or acknowledgement. The best thing to read actually isn't my book. The first thing to read is Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. The man was an absolute genius. You don't go talking to a person about what you want or who you are. You start by asking sincere questions that show some appreciation for what he brings or has to offer or his experiences. So for example, let's work through the case of a libertarian trying to talk to a progressive. That seems to be what's really on a lot of libertarian minds nowadays. So rather than starting off with, you know, you guys think that you're caring, but actually your policies hurt the very people you're trying to help. So rather than starting off that way, if you would say, I think something that liberals and libertarians have in common is that, you know, we're really concerned about the plight of people who just aren't making it in today's economy. Let's talk about what, you know, something isn't working for them. And right away, you're acknowledging that the core concern of modern progressives, at least they say that the core concern is the poor, I think especially the African-American poor. But, so if you start by saying, you know, I share your concern is valid. I don't think you're a crazy person. You know, and what do you think we should do about this? Right away, that communicates that you're not in combat mode. You're not trying to defeat them. And that puts them on a fundamentally different cognitive purpose. So I don't think you have to speak their love language. I think you just have to start, as Dale Carnegie would, by validating them, by saying, you know, your concerns are valid and I'm interested in them. And then by the magic of reciprocity, you will find them much more open to what your concerns are.
So is this more or less the conclusion that you draw at the end of your research, or what else do you want to add here to make sure that we've painted as full a picture as we can in 20 minutes?
That's the first third of the book, is all these weird cognitive things, the confirmation bias, the fact that we're not very rational. The most important message to take from that, and one that I would love to leave listeners with on your show, is ultimately you can call it moral humility or you can call it epistemological humility. It's the realization that as individuals, we're actually not all that smart on our own. We're certainly not as smart as we think we are as individuals. But when you put us together in a system in the right way, amazing stuff happens. And I think actually libertarians are quite receptive to this way of thinking. They're the main people who understand the brilliance of a market when there's no central mind. So if you realize that we're all basically neurons, and neurons aren't really all that smart, and that our genius comes from getting the system right, and then you got to kind of realize, boy, the American system right now is just not working very well. It's not working very, you know, markets work brilliantly, but man, our political system is just not doing a good job of either aggregating preferences or aggregating information from research, whatever it is, there's something really wrong. And it's getting worse because we're getting more emotionally polarized. We hate each other more. A moment ago, you talked about what, you know, why we do voting, why we vote. And I forgot, there's some new research. Increasingly, Americans are voting in order to vote against something. The role of anger and hatred is getting much stronger in our democracy. And these are all worrisome signs. So a little more epistemological humility from all of us, I think, would make our democracy work a little better.
Before I let you go, I'm curious to know, your book apparently was a New York Times bestseller, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Did that surprise you? Had the success of the TED Talks come before or after this book?
The TED Talks came before, and I guess that helped. What really helped was that I did an interview with Bill Moyers, which was aired a couple weeks before the book came out.
Oh, well, that doesn't hurt.
No, because, you know, I was on the Colbert Show, and that barely made any difference in sales later on.
How funny!
Well, because people go to Colbert to laugh, but man, people go to Bill Moyers. They, you know, they're really thinking about it, and they bought the book.
Yeah.
So I was a little surprised in that the way to be a bestseller is to say terrible things about the left, and then conservatives buy you, or you say terrible things about the right, and then liberals buy you. So, you know, that's a good way for political books to get out. It's very hard for a nonpartisan political book to do well. So I was surprised and very pleased by that.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Jonathan Haidt. It was a great pleasure chatting. But of course, we're just getting to the tip of the iceberg here. But as I say, I always leave my guests, I like to leave the audience wanting more, right? Because if you want more, there's a whole book on this. We've got resources linked to tomwoods.com/429. Of course, we're linking to The Righteous Mind. We're going to link to your faculty page. We're going to link to I'll link to How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Oh,
everything that we talked about, your article, parlio.com, it'll all be there.
Great. May I also suggest yourmorals.org, which is my research site. People can take surveys to find out how they score on those moral foundations.
Oh, absolutely. Yourmorals.org. That will also be there. Oh, my listeners will have fun with that.
Great.
All right, well, John, best of luck with everything, and thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Tom. This was great fun.
All right, everybody. Remember my brand new ebook on how to start your blog or website, even if you know nothing about it, which is like me. I know nothing about how to create a website from scratch or anything like that. But here are some resources that can make it easy on you to go from no blog to blog. I show you how to do it in just 5 minutes, and then I give you all kinds of tools and tips and tricks that I've used to build up my online presence, to build up a mailing list so I can keep in touch with people, get them coming back, all kinds of tips. Like, for instance, I sometimes say on this show that you can text the word liberty to 33444 and get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, plus my free weekly letter. Well, how do I do that? That and other tips you can find in my new ebook. You can find that ebook over at freewebsitebook.com. freewebsitebook.com. That's freewebsitebook.com. Also, we've been talking about liberalism and conservatism and libertarianism. And remember that we've got a brand new course at libertyclassroom.com, which is the history of conservatism and libertarianism. We now have 13 courses that you can listen to on the go and learn the history and economics they didn't teach you. Over at libertyclassroom.com, use coupon code SHOW in all caps to get a discount. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Bob Murphy. Bob's going to be talking to us about Robert Reich and all the errors his videos are spreading all over the internet and Facebook in particular. A lot of you folks have been asking for a show dealing with Robert Reich, and you got it. It's tomorrow. So make sure and tune in. Make sure and subscribe at TomWoods.com on iTunes or Stitcher, and we'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.